Welcome to Mean Age Daydream with me, Brian McWilliams, where we're going to be making some jokes, laughing out at broken world, but also laying out some philosophy for the future, how we can fix this mess we're in and have a great time doing it all with a Mean Age Daydream. Welcome, welcome everybody to Mean Age Daydream. For those of you watching the stream, you could tell I am not alone. Although, am I ever alone with you, my wonderful listeners? I say no. But I'm in fact joined physically via the internet by a very interesting guest. I'm very happy to have him on, Dr. David T. Beto. Now, am I saying that right? I meant to ask you before the show.
You nailed it. Yeah, you
all
got
right.
It.
Thank goodness. I just want to make sure. So I'm really happy to have Dr. Beto on. Now, Dr. Beto is a research fellow at the Independent Institute, professor emeritus with the University of Alabama. You have a PhD in history, and you have a very long list of authored works, all focusing on topics that I'm sure my audience is interested in, talking about civil rights, talking about liberty, talking about the creation of the welfare state and where it's gotten us here. But we are here today to talk about your newest book, which I will hold up right here, which is The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights. And we're talking about FDR. We're talking about some of the things that he brought into play that not many people know about. And of course, he's regarded as one of the quote-unquote greatest presidents in history. So let's look forward to tearing that down. So Dr. Beto, welcome to Mean Age Daydream. I think the best way to start off is just, if you don't mind, giving us a little bit of, the 30 seconds on where you're coming from, you know, your interest, obviously liberty-centric, and what led you to create this new book, this new work.
Well, I'd written a lot about the 1930s and other aspects, and always been fascinated by the period because it's a turning point in American history. And I've been fascinated by Roosevelt, and I've read a lot about Roosevelt. I've read a lot of biographies of him. And when I actually look at primary source documents, I don't see a very attractive figure. I don't see a figure that lines up with the kind of depiction, right, of this humanitarian guy. I think there's a ruthlessness to him. There's a coldness to him. And there's a kind of attitude that's very ideological. I do think he's an ideological guy, but there's limits. You know, he's pragmatic too, if he has to be. But that kind of an idea of that comes out of progressivism, that whatever you need to accomplish, don't worry so much about the procedures that you use. In fact, Roosevelt's closest advisors note that about him. So he didn't really care much about rules. He didn't care about procedures. He didn't care much about due process. If he wanted something done, anything to accomplish that.
Well, I did find it interesting, you know, talking about some of the issues in the book. You highlight how, of course, you know, he created the New Deal. Then that's what the left loves about him, right? These protections in place and taking care of the common man. And yet what we saw, I think, thoroughly throughout his tenure, and as you document in the book, like you said, he didn't really seem to care about a lot of the rights of the common man. We know about the internment camps, the concentration camps that he created in regards to the Japanese prisoners. But you also talk about how it wasn't just that he was content trampling people's rights, but a lot of these internment camps were actually, in your opinion and from documents, also based in a history of racist remarks against Asian and you know, Pacific people from that Pacific side of the world. So do you want to tell me a little bit about that? And because I want to talk about the concentration camps, I want to talk about then getting into some of the topics that are going to, I guess, leverage into our current society: censorship, mass surveillance, and then getting into a little bit of I guess, lawfare and going to tax returns. But first, let's start with FDR and his racism. That transcends everybody, right? We can all get interested in racism on the left or the right.
Yeah, and your statement that these are concentration camps is one thing where the historical profession tends to kind of rewrite ways that we put things. And in this case, I wholly agree with them. The term concentration camps is spot on. Now, I'm not saying these are the same as the Nazi death camps on that scale or as evil as those, but they're concentration camps. They have guard towers. They have barbed wire. You're shot if you try to escape. And that is that happened. And FDR called them concentration camps. I don't think there's a better argument than that. He called them concentration camps as late as 1944. Now, the way FDR is often portrayed on this, I was able to say something somewhat new, or at least publicize something new about internment. And one of the things that I found is FDR is a hands-on guy. He's always a hands-on guy. He's very well informed. He reads several newspapers a day. He gets all sorts of briefings. He's not in a vacuum. And he knows what he's doing when it comes to internment. But if you look at history books, history textbooks, some historians have caught on to this. You'll see, well, he didn't really, you know, it's bad that he did this. They're all going to say that, right? But, you know, you got this hysteria. And they'll quote these polls, which I could point out problems with them. Oh, most Americans supported internment. There was hysteria. You know, he had to do it. It's sort of like FDR and race. That's what people say. Well, he had to get his New Deal, so he had to appease the South. Always these excuses made for him that he's this one term was he's a distracted figure. Well, I find he's hands-on, but also this comes out of a larger context. FDR had written op-eds back in the 1920s for a paper in Georgia called the Macon Daily Register. And in there, he said, I wholly agree with the state of California, which is prohibiting interracial marriage with Japanese, prohibiting immigration, or at least the government, you know, U.S. government prohibiting more immigration, and California's law banning the right of Japanese immigrants to buy land. He said, I agree with that, and we don't need a commingling of the races. That's going to lead to trouble. Okay, you could say that's 1920s, but then later, when he's president, he has this, this is, you know, again, in a meeting, he basically says, look, if we ever have a war with Japan, we need to put any Japanese American who had met with Japanese ship, fraternized in any way with Japanese sailors in a, concentration camp in the event of war. So he's primed and ready to do this, but FDR is very good at making it look like, well, other people are sort of doing this. The military did this. He had all sorts of advice. Including from the military and other places. His own attorney general was against internment. FBI Director Hoover, Attorney General Ickes. He had all sorts of people saying this is not a good idea. So it's not like he was helpless. And if actually you talk about polls, you look at the early response in California and you look at some polls that were done in February 1942, they find very little support for locking the Japanese Americans up in concentration camps. Yeah. Even California newspapers are saying, look, these people are citizens, leave them alone. So
FDR, what a novel time in history. What a novel time in history where people are actually noticing that, hey, this we could be going down a very slippery slope here and warning us that our civil rights are in danger, which you just don't see today.
I see a lot of heroes during this time. And I want people on the left to read my book because a lot of them were on the left. A lot of them were New Dealers. A lot of them were socialists who were civil libertarians who actually would say, I don't like these conservatives, but I want to defend their rights. You had that happen a lot. And you had the opposite occur too. That's one thing we've lost that I would hope my book maybe get people thinking about. Left-right coalitions for civil liberties, because they did exist in the 1930s. There were people pushing back on FDR from inside the administration. I guess you could say the deep state, in some sense, was pushing back on to FDR. He would often press subordinates to do things they didn't want to do, which is a lot different than Woodrow Wilson, where Wilson would tend to say, well, you know, do you really have to throw that guy in jail? And his attorney general would say, yeah, we do. And Wilson said, all right, you're the boss. You know, FDR is doing the opposite. He's putting pressure on people like his attorney general to do much more to violate civil liberties than they wanted to do. And so they try to hold him off, and they are successful sometimes, but very often not successful. So he's the decider, as George Bush would say. He's going to be, that's what everybody says about him, right? Oh, he's the guy that's in the hand on the tiller, energetic, strong leader. Well, he is on this too. So I'm just being consistent with the overall portrait, which I think is accurate, that he knows what he wants. Whatever you say about him.
I thought it was interesting, and this is a thought that I don't know if it crossed your mind at all. I doubt it's crossed many people's minds, but there is always, you know, that the United States was aware that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, that essentially FDR and others were itching to get into the war and to maintain that. Do you think that racism and his hatred of Japanese people had any part to maybe wanting to get involved and wanting to be able to legally have us go to war with that nation per the Pearl Harbor attack?
Yeah, and I don't want to get into that debate as to whether he knew specifically there was going to be an attack on Pearl Harbor. I think that's debatable. I think he knew an attack was coming, though. That's pretty clear. They know an attack is coming, whether it's in the Philippines or whatever. And FDR makes all sorts of racist comments. He once said that there was there were these apes who went to the Japanese islands, and they had relations with the inhabitants there, and the offspring were the Japanese people, right? Mm. He would say things like that. Yeah. So, I mean, he's much more sympathetic, by the way, towards China. And I think that that has a lot to do with the family's investments and that kind of thing. So it's interesting that on the Chinese, I think there's a little bit of a more positive attitude that he has.
That's interesting. Well, let's talk. So let's go a little bit more into some of the other things that I think people aren't necessarily aware of. I think that you talk a lot about in the book about, you know, mass, I guess, his censorship and his uses of radio, right? The fireside chats aspect. He was very famous for this, but people don't realize just how dedicated I think he had media members to him. You know, the Radio Commission at the time, now the FCC, they had essentially pledged, you have the airwaves at your disposal, correct? And that they would, similar to what we saw, I think during COVID, similar to what we saw when we were talking about, you know, combating disinformation, it seemed that, and I highlighted, you know, one passage that was very handy here. It seemed that they were committed to countering, and this is saying rejecting any broadcast that in any way was critical of the policy of the administration. And this was from Henry A. Bellows, I believe, had committed that. So can we talk a little bit more about that? Because I do think that it's fascinating that we saw this originated almost during FDR, and yet we saw the exact same thing more or less playing out in our current era.
Little did I know this was going to happen, because I've been working on this book for 15 years.
This is why they call you Nostradamus of
the Institute. And you see, who could tell, right? But you see parallel after parallel, including the crusade against fake news. In fact, the term was used. Mm-hmm. FDR saw himself as somebody who was a crusader against fake news, against false news. And that's sort of part of what he's doing. Now, it's interesting, if you look at the press, and maybe a bit different than today, the print press was generally anti-FDR. In fact, in every election, they would editorially, at least the print press was, would endorse the Republicans. However, radio was really in FDR's hip pocket. And a lot of that is because he's able to use things like the Federal Communications Commission, Federal Radio Commission before that. He's able to use things like an early version of the equal time rule. He's able to just sort of jawbone the networks. And then initially, once the New Deal is coming about, the networks give him carte blanche. They said, do whatever you want. by 1938, there not is not a single anti-New Deal commentator. And the commentators are really big during this time. Not a single one left on network radio. And there had been several. There was a guy named Bo Carter, for example. Another guy, Hugh Johnson, who was a turncoat, had been a big New Dealer. And these people are forced off the air. And it's done through the kind of method where, you know, and I've got the correspondence where the FDR's advisors would contact advertisers, like, for example, Marjorie Merriweather Post, who original owner of Mar-a-Lago, whose husband was kind of a pro-communist ambassador to the Soviet Union. But anyway, she was one of the sponsors of one of these leading anti-New Deal commentators, and they just used her as kind of a middle person to go to the network and say, we really don't like this. Tone this guy down or get him off the air. It's sort of like the whole Twitter files thing.
Yeah.
It really is. And it's done through a multitude of methods. You got another thing too, where the networks just know that you look at stations, they got, I think it was like a 18 month renewals for licenses. And they shorten that to 6 months as a matter of practice. So every 6 months, you got to be really worried as to whether your license will be renewed. And this is just common. People, they're not going to take any chances because, you know, you want to fight that. You know, you got to send attorneys, and you don't have that kind of money necessarily if you're a local stations, and the networks are tied into that. So they're very cooperative.
I mean, it is, like you said, it's amazing because we're seeing it play out, you know, especially the use of advertisers. You know, so many progressive organizations are, I'd say, unbelievably effective at mobilizing advertisers in order to get what they want. And Elon Musk, of course, his billions of dollars, he's able to reject it. But you look at so many of these other places that are just completely bending over backwards and saying, okay, fine, we're going to go along with this. We're going to remove content. We're going to censor. I mean, I wonder, as you said, there was an interesting pushback only from print. And did that happen organically more? Do you think it's something in the way similar to how our corporate media today is unbelievably left-leaning, you know, for the most part? Do you think that the broadcast, you know, before the strong arming, was the broadcast environment, was television that time also, do you think, similarly split? Do you think it's just kind of a natural way in which things go, where people that have more progressive values tend to nest in those industries, a tale as old as time type of thing?
No, I think it's all basically institutional. I mean, if you look at, and I decided my book focuses on the New Deal period, but I just decided I had to do an extra chapter describing radio, the development of radio before FDR came on board. What I found is if you look at radio in the early 1920s, it's arguably freer than the print press. Now, imagine that. But that was pre-FCC. That was pre-federal regulation. There's kind of a de facto system of property rights. And so in many ways, it's freer than the print press, which still had things like prior restraint laws. What happens in the late 20s is radio becomes highly regulated under Hoover, interestingly enough, and the print press is sort of freed up. I think what you also have with the print press is you have some money there, right? You have some big circulation papers. They got some money behind them. And if the publisher just decides, you know, that they don't like FDR, and a lot of these publishers had supported FDR initially, and they turn against them, they got resources. The number one paper in terms of circulation, the two biggest ones were the New York Daily News, run by Joseph Patterson, and the Washington Times Herald, run by his sister Sissy Patterson. When they turned against FDR, they had millions of subscribers against them. I mean, to back them up. So they were very influential and got FDR very mad. He wanted to prosecute them during World War II, but you know, his attorney general said, look, they're all supporting the war now after Pearl Harbor. You don't have a case. He wanted to go after them. They called them the McCormick-Patterson Axis because you had their cousin of the Pattersons was the very conservative publisher of the Chicago Tribune. And these are arguably the three biggest papers in the country, and they don't like FDR. And he hates this. And he wants to go after them legally and prosecute them for sedition and anything he can come up with.
I like that David Frum, he calls them the axis, almost the axis of evil. You know, I wonder if that was inspired David Frum and his George Bush axis of evil commentary.
Well, they're obviously inspired by the axis.
Right. Has to be. So, yeah.
And, you know, and I look at some of this stuff, like I went on Wikipedia and I looked at Patterson's, the biography of both of those, is they were conservative Republicans. I said, boy, people have the history wrong. They were FDR supporters until 1941 when they turned against him on foreign policy. They were close to him. The Pattersons were pals. FDR, you know, called them on the first name basis. But anyway, the historians really...
Hey guys, want to take a quick minute to talk about our sponsor, Crowd Health. Now, Crowd Health is a different way of looking at healthcare. And I know if you're like me, you've dealt with a lot of BS from insurance companies. I am still, to this day, getting calls about some nonsense bills from years ago from an insurance company that I no longer have, but like their secondary provider is now trying to come after me for hundreds of dollars in fees. It's ridiculous. With Crowd Health, they take care of it. They pay up front. It's all right there to your provider directly. There's no hassle. They also negotiate fees for you to get it down. And considering that 1 in 5 Obamacare claims were denied last year, which is unacceptable, it's awesome to have a new way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. Now, the process of health insurance is kind of, you know, nefarious. It's hidden behind closed doors. With Crowd Health, it's wide open. You operate within a voluntary community that helps pay each other's bills. It's really dying in exactly to what we visualize when we talk about a libertarian concept of healthcare. And for just $175 for an individual or $575 for a family of four or more, you get access to that community who are helping out with emergencies. You get telemedicine, you get discounted prescriptions, and much more. So please check out Crowd Health and get started today for just $99 per month for the first 3 months by using LIONS at joincrowdhealth.com. Again, code LIONS at joincrowdhealth.com. Jump on that $99 offer. And remember, Crowd Health is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com.
I think maybe some of this is Rachel Maddow's book. They want to see things in these binaries.
Yeah.
And they don't recognize that there's nuances. A lot of the people that didn't like FDR had been New Dealers initially and remain New Dealers often in some ways, but don't like what he's doing on civil liberties, that kind of thing.
Well, this is, I mean, this is off topic, but, you know, we have a bit of time we'll circle back around and we'll talk about mass surveillance in a moment. But you did bring up an interesting topic to me. And I think to most of the people watching is, you know, you have a PhD in history. You're a professor at the University of Alabama. When you look as a historian across the spectrum, as you said, you feel like it's getting very binary. Where do you think things are? I mean, obviously, when we have the New York Times and the 1619 Project, I think is a good example of how a binary system, a binary way of looking at history and people finding facts that basically will forward their whatever political ambitions might be rather than looking at actual history. Do you feel that that's getting better or worse after the last few years? I mean, did it have any impact on you, leaving education, I should say, to pursue other interests?
Well, I haven't left education exactly. I'm an emeritus professor, so right. I'm still writing and doing all those things. But yeah, I think in a lot of ways it's gotten worse. I compared to when I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, and I was the only kind of libertarian there. But they liked that, you know. They sort mm-hmm. of, oh, there's David again, you know. And I think I might have gotten better grades because they kind of liked that, because the professors then were all on the left, but they just said they got bored.
Yeah,
you know. Oh, everybody agrees with me, and really shortly after that, you start to see professors that basically demand a kind of uniformity. you see that phenomenon occurring a lot more. Now, I've written a lot on civil rights history. I wrote a biography about Dr. T.R.M. Howard. And, you know, frankly, I've done a lot of primary research on that. Howard is very important in the Emmett Till case. So, you know, I know people in that realm, and I've been somewhat successful. In fact, have you heard of Joy Reid?
Unfortunately.
Well, this is interesting how you can be surprised sometimes.
Oh, no. Don't tell me she was one of the star pupils. And I thought,
that Joy Reid? She did a biography of Medgar Evers, Medgar and Merle Evers, and it's pretty good. And she cites me favorably. So, I mean, it's interesting. You get these little surprises occurring. So because of my work in that area, I got some credentials, I guess you could say. And I think the FDR book, I'll say somewhat not so modestly, I really am proud of it. I did a lot of primary documents research to back up these points. It's not one of these books that, you know, someone just churns out. It took a long time to accomplish. And I want people on the left to read it. I want people to learn from it on the left, to maybe say, hey, this is in some interesting insights here, or to take it down. And that's the one thing that's obviously discouraging, that, you know, I want more of that. And I'm not getting a lot of interest from people on the left, to look at it.
I wonder if there's also something to be said about the publishers, because I know a lot of publishers now, you're seeing a politicization within publishing as a whole, you know, refusing to work with certain authors. It doesn't even matter what the topic is half the time. It's just that they themselves will be branded as some sort of undesirable to the left. I mean, do you think that's having a chilling effect on history as well, on biographies like yours? For example, you're working with the Independent Institute. They are going to publish your book, but in a larger sense, when you think about, you know, maybe a Penguin would refuse to publish something like this, saying, well, we can't have attacks on FDR's character as racist. He's a hero to most of our editors. And do you think that is becoming more prevalent as well?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think so. And I sort of made efforts to get this published by big, whatever you want to call it,
trade press presses.
Yeah. And not even really interested in looking at it. It's not like they rejected what I'd done. They just didn't really, there wasn't much curiosity there. And I've been published by, you know, good university presses and everything. But ultimately, I decided to go with the Independent Institute because they sold it at a good price, and they did what I wanted. And they had referees, right? They had people read it over with a critical eye, but they made it. It has the illustrations, the price, the look of it, and they spent all kinds of time with me trying to catch typos. And it's just amazing infrastructure the Independent Institute has. So would I have published with trade press if I could have? Maybe. But it's just so discouraging. And so I said, I'm going to go with the Independent. And they did my book on T.R.M. Howard, too, which is, a book that's been praised by a lot of people on the left, one of the leading works on civil rights during this period. And that's one thing I would recommend to classical liberals, libertarians, is do original work. Go out there. You know, if you're going to look at racism or whatever, foreign policy, do the nitty-gritty work. Don't just rely on secondary works, and become as good as you can. And you're gonna get some creds for that, for doing your homework, for digging into the primary documents.
Well, let's talk about some more digging you did. We'll return to the main topic of the book, which, of course, if you guys are just watching, we got a lot of people watching the live stream. Thank you for that, which is The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights, the untold story of FDR's concentration camps, censorship, and mass surveillance. So we've checked off the concentration camps and censorship for a bit. There's much more in the book, but let's talk about mass surveillance, because as you and I were bandying about a little bit before we jumped on here, one of the tactics, or the primary tactic that FDR used under, I believe it was Senator Black, was to sic him on his political opponents. And the primary way they did this was in reading communications that were going through any, I think anything that went through Washington, D.C. was fair game, if I, and correct me if I'm wrong, but also in going through their tax returns, which in our current environment with what's going on with Donald Trump is interesting, as well as the Biden administration trying to crack down on, you know, Venmo payments that are over $500 and you know, diving into our tax returns. So I'll let you give us the basics of what they did here a little bit more, more deeply, and then we could talk about our current day circumstances.
Well, you know, I say mass surveillance, and a lot of people instantly think, well, he's talking about the FBI. Actually, I'm not. I don't think the FBI was conducting what we would call mass surveillance at the time. You know, they had wiretaps on a couple hundred people every, you know, at any given time. It's not mass surveillance. But you did have a kind of interesting mass surveillance, and it was called through the Black Committee. And I'd never heard of this thing. I mean, I'd read a lot of literature critical of FDR. I'd never heard of this thing. But I would see conservatives talk about it in the 1940s and the 50s. So this is like the notorious Black Committee. So what are they talking about? So I looked into this, and this was a Senate committee that was set up in 1935. And it was set up at the behest of FDR, because at that point he was falling in the polls. There actually were pre-election polls in 1936, very credible ones, that showed him losing. You know, in early 36, he was losing a lot of elections, like these, you know, special elections and things like that. New York legislature went Republican in 1935, for example. So he's very worried about this, right? This rising anti-New Deal attitudes. So he basically recruits this senator from Alabama, Hugo Black. Black was a populist. He was a demagogue. If you see, I've listened to some of his speeches, and they're table pounding, you know, emotional rants, really quite interesting. But he's very, very pro Roosevelt. People in the administration said, if you want something done, go to Black. He has the ruthlessness and the smartness to do it. So anyway, they recruit Black, and Black starts calling in these anti-New Deal organizations, figures, and they fight back. And it's very frustrating. So he gets the idea. I don't know who got the idea, but he runs with it. Well, what if I could get their private telegrams? Right? That's not a small matter. Over 50% of long distance communication in this period was through private telegrams. It was the email and text of its time. And it was the parallels are very close. It was almost instantaneous. People would say things in telegrams that they would not say in emails or text. They didn't tend to save them, right? So it was very, very similar. So he gets the idea, said, well, what if I could get their private telegrams, thousands of them, right? And so what they do, what Black does, he goes to the telegraph companies. Western Union was the big one. Said, we want all telegrams sent in and out of Washington, sent by every to and from every single member of Congress, for example, right? This is a request. And Western Union says, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to be credible anymore. If you got a subpoena for a specific one, okay, but you don't even have a legal subpoena. So he goes to the FCC, and the FCC orders Western Union to comply. Western Union just decides at that point not to fight it. So they go down to the Western Union office, Black staffers and FCC people. And they start searching these telegrams. They pull out because under the law, the telegraph companies have to keep copies of the originals. So they got copies of all the originals of the telegrams. They go in there and they just start pulling out these big binders and start going through them, thousands a day of, for example, all telegrams in and out of Washington, D.C., to and from members of Congress. And they start looking. And of course, they have instructions. The people do. They say, well, don't, if you see anything private, just look past that. Look for anything having to do with lobbying. Well, what is lobbying? what we're doing. Any attempt to indirectly or directly influence public opinion, it could be just two people talking, right? It wouldn't even have to be the climate of public opinion, right? So they go through these thousands a day. And I couldn't believe this when I saw it. But it ended up being over 3 million. Hmm. And I read the papers and my God, they went through 3 million telegrams. But if you do the math, yeah, they do this for several months. It works out. And then they would call, Black would call in these witnesses and he would say, well, on June 8th, you said this. And, you know, he tried to blindside them and embarrass them. And I know FDR got some of these personally, or at least I have good reason to believe that. So it really was corrupt. Yeah. And then they start doing specific requests for specific critics of the New Deal, you know, in Chicago and other cities. And one of them in Chicago was named Silas Strawn, who is the head of the Chicago U.S. Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Golfing Association. He was head of the American Bar Association. This guy's power, right? And he's still a big law firm in Chicago with his name on it. Anyway, he fights this. He takes him to court because why does he take him to court? Because someone told him this was happening. So your telegrams are being searched with someone at Western Union. They wanted to challenge this. They quite clearly did. They wanted a lawsuit and he won. And there were other lawsuits. And Black sort of says at some point, well, we've already done our field work. We don't have to continue. And so Black cannot do any more, but he's already done maximum damage. Now, when this gets out to people that their telegrams are being searched, there's a lot of pissed off people, including a guy named Newton Baker, who was assistant secretary or secretary of war under Wilson, a moderate New Dealer. Baker finds out that his telegrams have been searched. And he says, if I saw someone trying to lynch Senator Black, I would not join the lynching. But if they were stringing the rope around his neck, I wouldn't stop them either. You know, this is a kind of mild mannered moderate, you know? So, there was a headline news. It was condemned by leading papers such as the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, New York Times. It's a big deal. And ultimately, they're not able to do this anymore because of these court rulings. So later congressional committees, I don't know about now, couldn't do these kinds of things because of precedents that were set here.
Now, they also got into, as I mentioned, not only reading their telegrams, but I think then they also get into going into tax returns as well. Was that a tax?
Oh, yeah. Sweeping things. That, again, the administration would say Black would request this. They said, sure. And other committees did this, too. And they would just say all tax returns going back to, you know, like 1920s, long before the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And they would they get copies of the tax returns. And if you were a critic of the New Deal, like a lot of these people, the prominent people, you had to be very careful with your taxes. You know, you had got tax rates during this time of over 90%, mm-hmm. marginal tax rates. And of course, no one paid those. You know, they would find shelters and that kind of thing. But you had to be very careful. FDR is constantly not only doing that, he's constantly going to his Secretary of Treasury and say, I want you to audit this person. This person, this critic, and you got to give it to these critics that a lot of them have been very careful mm-hmm. to have the best lawyers to avoid any trouble. But
that's what
he's doing it left and right.
It's fascinating to me because you're seeing it, and it's just something that you know it's possible. I mean, in the Obama era, there was an issue with the IRS, I guess, questioning the tax status of some conservative groups and not leftist groups. But now what's going on in New York State with Donald Trump certainly seems like they are using the exact same tactics you're describing here because Donald Trump.
This is worse in some ways than you saw in the 30s, because there were a lot of people on the left that would go, hey, wait a minute, that's going too far. And we see the same thing with sedition trials now. There were a lot of critics of sedition. When there wasn't a mass sedition trial during World War II on trumped up charges of about 30 critics of the administration, cranks and, you know, unsavory characters in some cases, who were brought all into Washington and prosecuted for sedition under very weak charges. And sedition is, by its very nature, a weak charge. And that's, I've been rather disappointed that more conservatives and libertarians haven't questioned that, because sedition is whatever you want it to be. It's open-ended. And I'll say the same thing for domestic terrorism. There are 100%. Environmentalists now being prosecuted in Atlanta for domestic terrorism. Very similar. Just because they go to a demonstration or something. But what does it mean? You can't object to it, because what does that mean? It could mean anything. It is in the eye of the beholder. And when these sedition trials started, when these domestic terror, I said, no, we can't allow this. All right. People on 9/11 or people on J6 were guilty of vandalism. Prosecute them for vandalism. They were guilty of violence. Prosecute them for that. You can go down the line. Sedition? Hmm. You're just trying to make a political point here. It's very dangerous. And it could be turned against the left, and is being turned against the left when you look at domestic terrorism, which is very similar. So it could be used by anybody, and that's historically. And I thought these trials were over. When I started this book, I thought, oh, that sedition trials? You know, we don't have those anymore. We really didn't. And now we have them all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really insane to see where we've gotten. And as you said, a lot of those same topics, you know, like I remember under Obama, enemy combatant was a phrase that was now essentially, as you said, an open-ended term, because an enemy combatant now meant that they could go after domestic, you know, enemies as well as foreign. And by classifying people as enemy combatants, it also removed under Obama their rights to habeas corpus. And so it's, as you said, these are things that can be used against anybody. And it always shocks me that the short-sightedness of opening these type of trials up, you know, for a Donald Trump, for example, you know, you've got them going after him for essentially when it comes to his overvaluing of assets, that's a subjective thing by its nature. You know, you're going to have somebody give an assessment of a value of properties and whatever else. To think that won't be turned against people at some point in time, unless you nip it in the bud, is absolutely psychotic. But
can I say something real quick about that?
Oh, please. Yeah. Oh,
by all means. You know, who was the Donald Trump in the 1930s that was really hated and seen as very similar views, actually, kind of a right-wing nationalist, was William Randolph Hearst. Mm-hmm. He was the bad guy, right, for a lot of people on the left and the right. You know, he was just seen as ruthless. He was seen as opportunistic. A lot of the same criticisms of Trump sounded a lot like Trump, too. But the Black Committee got a hold of a private telegram that Hearst had sent, which wasn't particularly incriminating. You know, he called someone a communist. He told some editor, well, write about this guy. He's like a communist, you know, whatever, you know. And he released it thinking it would produce sympathy for the Black Committee. But what happened was members of Congress, including New Dealers, the ACLU, said, you can't do that. William Randolph Hearst, we don't like him, but you can't do that to him. He's an American citizen. I wish I could see more of that happen now. But Hearst is really a close parallel to Trump. And there was a willingness of people to stand up for Hearst. That there would,
I think, you know, his I right. think the ACLU yeah. is on the prosecution for Trump at this point in time.
Yeah, and I'm not a Trump guy at all. I don't like him.
Me neither.
I don't like a lot of people, you know, that are too soft on him. I've been very hard on him, as you might know, but on including people that, you know, praise him needlessly, I think. But still, he is an American citizen. You know, and you can make all sorts of points about that. Well, what about other people? And people said that about Hearst. He says, well, why do you care about Hearst? What about this poor guy who's being prosecuted for some stupid reason? It's like, you know, that same argument was made. Well, yeah, that shouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
No, but you're establishing exactly. precedence here. That's the important thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, is there anything else you want to add? So I'm going to wrap up here. I appreciate the time you spent. We're going, I try to cap things about 45 minutes, I find is the sweet spot for my episodes. So is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you do want to highlight in the book? And of course, there's a lot here. I encourage everybody to check it out. As you said, it's the the shocking way in which things are playing out in history is repeating itself in our current era, stemming from this book, are fascinating. But what did we miss, or what would else would you like to tell people? Where can they find you? Where should they follow along with what you're doing and your work?
Well, I would think, you know, I mean, I think that the role of race here is actually quite interesting. And there are some people that people haven't heard of, like J.B. Martin, who was head of the Negro Baseball League, one of the wealthiest blacks in the country, but who is also a local Republican in Memphis at a time when blacks could vote in Memphis. And there was a ruthless crackdown on him by the city boss in Memphis, who was an FDR ally. There were loud complaints about this guy's methods, and the administration showed no interest. The strong arm tactics that were used by the federal government during World War II to silence the black press, because the black press is very critical of a lot of things the federal government is doing. And the message is basically given to them: if you don't end some of this criticism or tone it down, we're going to prosecute you for sedition. And that would have been difficult politically for the administration to do, because these are big papers. They, you know, a lot of African Americans read them. So that part of the story, too, the sedition laws and how they're used against minorities, I think is an important part of the story, but I don't segment them out. I see this as all part of a puzzle, right? Japanese internment is obviously the biggest piece, but you have other pieces. But it all ties in together into FDR's attitudes and the New Deal's attitudes towards the protections on the Bill of Rights and issues like surveillance.
I love it. Fascinating. You've been a wonderful guest, and I've enjoyed every moment talking to you. To remind everybody out there, this book is available. It is The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights, The Untold Story of FDR's Concentration Camps, Censorship, and Mass Surveillance, published by the Independent Institute. Of course, thank you so much, Dr. David T. Beto. I've enjoyed you being here, and I've linked to where people can buy the book in the show notes as well. So thank you, sir. Appreciate you coming on Mean Age Daydream.
It's been great. Thank you.
All right. We'll have you on again for sure. For you out there watching, thank you. Please subscribe to the show. Hit the notification button on YouTube, because we are shadow banned, as you know. Hit subscribe, and I will see you later. Thank you all, and talk to you soon.